Once more unto the breach, dear friends.
Else fill the wall up with our English dead.
Good morning again, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to another exciting second hour of the Personal Wealth Coach, where we will say such exciting things as GDP, payrolls, and medium weekly wage, and things to that effect, just as exciting as that. If that stimulates your brain, you are listening to the correct place. If it causes your insomnia to disappear, you are also listening to the correct place. I have heard, just as a side note, a large number of people that listen to our podcasts to go to sleep. So we may want to put an extra disclosure about operating heavy vehicles while listening to these two bald guys.
I would venture to say that everyone who listens to our podcasts at some point goes to sleep.
I would hope so. Unless it's the last thing that they do ever.
I mean, at some point during the day, they will go to sleep.
Yes. What I'm talking about, though, is people specifically listening to us to go to sleep.
Mm.
That they enjoy our conversation, but that sometimes when they are just relaxing, they turn on our podcast just so that they can go to sleep.
That makes sense.
So if we're fulfilling a need of yours, whether that is education or insomnia release,
this has not
been FDA approved for the treatment of any health, anything.
We should do a double blind, because it would fit us very nicely, survey,
right,
experiment to determine whether people have less insomnia if they're listening to us or more.
I think that the survey may also fight insomnia.
Mm. Could be.
We go out and do a survey and ask them to fill out 120 questions about whether or not they sleep.
Nope.
Well, no.
Just ask them. Just say, do you listen to our podcast? And it's a yes or no. Two, do you have insomnia? Yes or no.
And if they say no, then we know we've cured a lot of them.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, we compare that with the general population to determine how many people in the general population have insomnia.
This is absolutely the way you should do large number studies. I mean, every academic researcher will say, oh, yeah, that's fine. That'll pass peer review.
We could compare listening to nothing to listening to us and see if it puts people to sleep.
Well, first, you have to find nothing. Wait, we've been doing it for the past five minutes.
No, nothing is in middle schools.
It's what they learn in middle school, yeah.
Because
you asked them what they learned.
We had five children that went through middle school, and all five of them, when they come home from middle school, you said, I would ask them, what did you do today? And they would say, nothing. So nothing is being created in the middle schools.
Yes.
Across the country.
So we can compare what isn't learned at middle school against our voices recorded for
sleep treatments. Right.
Yes.
Right.
All right. No.
So let's talk about some economic news. What do you think?
That's probably why people are listening. Hopefully.
Okay.
Or it could be that we put them all asleep already. So go ahead.
Well, there were several items of economic news that were significant. One was widely expected, except apparently by the people who trade on Wall Street in the markets. And that is that the Federal Reserve did not change short-term interest rates. They left them planned for a range of 5.25% to 5.5%. And Chairman Powell of the Federal Reserve Board said the same thing they have been saying for at least 6 months, probably more like 9 months at this point, higher longer than you expect. Interest rates and the speeches before the blackout period, before the meeting, consistently conveyed a message that the issue at this point is not whether we're going to raise rates or not. It's we're going to keep rates higher for a long time because the economy, very frankly, the economy is doing just about what the Fed wants it to do right now, short term. The inflation rate is somewhere between 1.2 and 2.4%. They're shooting for 2, so that's bracketing it very nicely, depending on which measure you use and which month you look at. Not the annual inflation rate, which is between 3.4 and 3.7 from looking back 12 months, but what is it running month to month right now? Now, there's no guarantee it'll keep on doing that, but it's doing just about what they wanted. And Jake mentioned earlier, I don't know if he mentioned it on the air before the show, the unemployment rate rose to 3.9. Well, the Fed's target is 4%.
Yeah, I said that before the program started. So, yeah.
So 3.9% unemployment, because it rose a little bit, And then once he got done and talking and everything, and then almost like a couple of days later, here comes the Bureau of Labor Statistics, one of our favorite organizations of the government, and where they're truly bureaucrats in the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And they came out with their first estimate for the recent quarter, and the third quarter, and they said that, for the month, last month, right, for October, 150,000 new employees, 150 net. In other words, if you take all the layoffs and quits and you compare that with all the hires, they came in with their first estimate. They have three estimates they're going to make. And they said 150,000. Well, that is almost precisely the number for a stable, enduring, sustainable economy. Now, it may have been influenced by the fact that General Motors workers are on strike. I don't know. We'll have to see how that works out.
Well, yeah, it did. It was Stellantis, Ford, and General Motors. That strike had an impact on...
Right.
It's noted in the report itself saying that had a significant impact on those numbers.
Well, it probably had some impact. But the point is, if you were to look for the perfect economy from the Federal Reserve's point of view, it'd be 4% unemployment, 150,000 new jobs a month, and inflation running along between 1.2 and 2.4. And folks, we got it. We are in the Goldilocks zone. Now, whether we'll stay there is the big question. But this is the interesting point. We are in the Goldilocks zone following the highest, fastest raise in interest rates in terms of where it started and where it in percentages that we've had since we've been keeping records on this. And the economy is running very smoothly after getting hit with the equivalent of a sledgehammer in interest rates. And so they're going to leave the sledgehammer in place for a while.
Yeah. And I want to just mix the metaphors, analogies a little bit more, because you know what happened to Goldilocks, right? She was sleeping in a bed when the bears came home.
Right.
So if we're in the Goldilocks zone, it's because we're in a nice bed and we ate the right temperature of porridge and we sat in the right chair. But then, so I'm just saying that when people say Goldilocks zone, I'm not sure that they're really...
Well, it's just thinking. Right.
It's just right, yeah.
And
this one's just right.
Is always followed by something other than just right. So, yeah, the bears could come home at any time when you least expect them. But we have not seen any evidence of bears prowling in the area recently. So this is about as good as it gets. And then came the whammy.
Mm-hmm.
Same Bureau of Labor Statistics, are one of our favorite organizations.
They are self-proclaimed
during
bureaucrats.
The third quarter, productivity in the United States grew at an annualized rate of 4.7%. That is huge. That means that the average or median... Oh, by the way, I forgot to mention, they lowered the new jobs numbers over the previous 2 months by 100,000. So that made the Fed happy too. And so... what we have is really fascinating, and we've talked about and written about for months now, that what we see going on beneath the surface is a lot of durable goods purchases for manufacturing. We've seen a lot of construction for manufacturing and not necessarily manufacturing. We're seeing durable goods orders by businesses, which means businesses are have a high level of business investment that's going on, and which is a very significant thing in the economy. And we see buildings being built for business. We see business owners buying stuff that's going to last a long time. This is what precedes. This is the kind of activity you see coming out of a major recession. When the business owners are optimistic about what's going to happen down the road, and they are closer to it than anybody else, and they start making long-term investments. And we're seeing that bear fruit now because the employees, now this is mainly on the service side, but employees are dramatically becoming more productive. And I think a piece of that is AI. A piece of that is better equipment. A piece of that is better layouts in buildings. But these are very, very, very positive long-term issues that are going on. It's capital investment for the purpose of raising productivity. And it's been going on for about a year now. And we would expect to see the fruit about now. And sure enough, the fruit has appeared. It's just astonishingly good news. Then came out a mixed story that tells you a lot about the economy, and I'm rambling on here, but I want to get this stuff out. The Institute for Supply Management came out with their Purchasing Managers Index. Now, Purchasing Managers Index is they survey a bunch of people who buy stuff. That's a technical term that economists use for businesses, because And that indicates whether the businesses think they will have more demand for processed stuff, be it food or equipment or whatever, in the future than they're having in the present. Well, the Purchasers Managers Index for services came out at 51.8, which is just about perfect. Again, it's pretty much what the Fed is looking for. And when you consider that about 78% of our economy is composed of services, and it's growing, it's still expanding, we're not going the other way. Now, on the backside of that, the manufacturing sector, that index was at 46.7, which means it's contracting. Now, it's better than it was, but it's still contracting. But this is the interesting thing. They also asked the purchasing managers their opinion about what's going on. And the purchasing managers on the manufacturing side say the reason there's no layoffs is because the bosses think there's going to be a resurgence in purchasing goods manufactured in the United States within the next year. And they didn't want to lay people off, because if they laid people off, they'd have to train people, and that's more expensive. So this is just incredibly good news. We're rocking and rolling along superbly in the United States economy. We are in, and we've said this before, we are in the condition of the economy is a lot more like what we would expect coming out of a major recession than it is about to go into a major recession.
And I'm going to add to that with some other things. We've saw this productivity spike. Well, what is that from? New software, new hardware. We've got new robotics and new equipment. Manufacturing is coming online. We're beginning to see a little bit of that money that's going into manufacturing in the United States since the pandemic really starting to bear fruit. So those productivity numbers are part of that. We're using more robots. We're onshoring jobs that we offshored and replacing the offshore jobs with robots. So that's fantastic. But it's not the end of the innovation. And I could spend a long time going back and forth on this, but I'm going to touch on a couple of really, really hot issues that are not being covered well right now. There are 43 companies currently, private companies, working on fusion power right now. 43 well-funded companies. There are 6 major countries working on it. The world's largest operating nuclear fusion reactor just happened in Japan. They named it very trippingly off the tongue. It is called the JT60SA. And when it turns on, it creates plasma. And during the time that it's on, it's creating more energy than it's using to create the plasma. So it's recreating the sun, basically, only under controlled circumstances. And that's happened across the board at quite a number of institutions at this point. We have had working fusion. We've just had trouble sustaining it. Well, over at Sandia National Labs, laboratories in the United States, they created the Sandia Z machine, which is a pulse energy fusion reactor that they got to sustain energy. Now, it's not extremely efficient, but it's about as efficient as nuclear, which is pretty good when you consider that. So the cost for it is still higher than it will be later. But now there's a company that is beginning the mass production of small fusion power plants. Functional prototypes already exist. What does that mean? It means that this is something that's been promised since my childhood. Hey, we're going to have fusion power. We can do this. And they keep saying next year, next year, next year for 40 plus years. Well, it's here. It's not in its most efficient form, but now it's about to start hitting the market, which means that people are going to see it as an alternative for other things that they're doing. That's one area. That is a renewable energy. It's going to come with its own drawbacks. We're not really sure what all those drawbacks are yet, but it's not a panacea. You have to provide the energy to get it started, which means you have to start it with some other energy than fusion. That's an interesting concept. That, as far as technology goes, when I look over on the battery end of things, we talked about this a bit last week, that Toyota is introducing a solid-state battery for its vehicles. next year with an expected range over 900 miles on one charge. That's phenomenal. What does that have to do with why we think the economy is going better? It isn't to say we don't like the equipment that we already have, but when we get better equipment, equipment that allows more things to be accomplished at a more efficient rate, that's what builds productivity. And long term, if you have a commercial vehicle and you're driving it and you have to stop every 300 miles or so and fill up on gas, or you can drive 900 miles and park it back in the motor pool and plug it in, how much efficiency is that? How much cost did you save? Those, we're beginning to see that. It isn't based on some kind of bad technology and good technology. This is always the case. This is there. I mean, most of our tall tales that we tell to our children are based on some new technology coming along and being fought off by the greatest of the hand tool users, whether that's Paul Bunyan or John Henry. You can go to almost any country and hear those stories about the people that did it so well, they did it better than a machine. But you can't do it consistently better than a machine for a long period of time. And now we're having those same kind of conversations about the old machine did it better in specific instances than the new machine. People talked about this when the steam engine was being replaced by the diesel engines on the railroad. And there were all these people saying, this is a horrible thing. The steam engine's going away. We love the steam engine. People are saying the same thing about internal combustion today. And I don't mean the ones that are saying, I don't want to go to electric because it won't get me where I need to go. That's just logic. That's good. If electric cars aren't going to work for you because you're taking a 1,000-mile trip, they don't work for you. And eventually, if they go 900-plus miles on a charge, that's how far you probably want to drive in a day anyway. And that's not the end. It's the people that drive their pickup trucks that they burn diesel in because they like the smoke and they park in front of the electric charging stations. These are the people that are making the legend of John Henry again. This is that argument. And people in the new technology side look at this and say, they're just horrible people for doing that. But the people driving the pickup truck that's blocking the electric is thinking the same thing about the new technology people. When I look at the economy, I look at behavior. And we have a large group of people in the behavior of, I'm never going to leave internal combustion. All it takes, though, is for electric vehicles to get cheaper and more efficient. And then those people leave. Because we don't have any lumbering companies that only use axes in the Great Northwest anymore. There's none of them. Because you can use one machine to go out there and clear out a huge amount of forest very easily. What were you going to add?
I was going to relate a personal experience. I have not been too favorably inclined towards electric cars until we visited our son in North Carolina, who has a plug-in hybrid. And we were able to drive around. He was out of the country and we were house sitting. And so we used his car and we were able to drive around most or all day touring and seeing things without burning any gasoline. And
it's a fun fuel.
Amazingly good. Among other things, you don't have to stop at a gas station and refuel, which is I always find to be tremendously inconvenient. So when we got back, my wife's car, she got notified by the dealer. She has an older Volvo that she was going to have to replace the engine soon. Apparently, it's a defect that they know about, but they're not going to do anything about it because you can drive the Volvo a really long time, this particular model of Volvo, before the engine needs replaced. But still, it's going to need to be replaced soon because the rings are gone. She's starting to burn oil. So she decided that given the price that she could get for the car at this point and the prices of cars and everything else, she would get a new Volvo. So she got a new Volvo and she got a plug electric Volvo. And I'm going to tell you, she enjoys it and I enjoy it more than I ever thought we would. It's you plug it in every night. She does her driving around during the day. And most days she burns no gasoline, which means you don't have to go fill the thing up with gas except once in a very long time. And that's significant. And the convenience is tremendous compared with what we had before. And it's got plenty of acceleration. It just does a an amazingly good job. And admittedly, we got a hybrid because if we ever want to go a long way, we don't want to have to worry about recharging over and over again and stopping because their batteries are not where they need to be. But for this was, I think, ideal.
There's other areas of technology that are occurring at the same time. There's a great article in the Wall Street Journal about this recently, how farmers are teaching old tractors to think for themselves. Mm-hmm. We've covered technology and farming causing productivity to skyrocket there. And at the beginning of the 20th century, 80% of our workforce was involved in agriculture, the year 1900. In the year 2000, 2% was. We are now below 0.2% and dropping rapidly. Well, how is that happening? Well, even the small farmer, which is pretty, as far as the overall acreage farmed, is a much smaller percentage, but the majority of farmers fall in the small farmer category. They're not the massive megalithic corporate farms. And almost universally, the small farmers have not paid $700,000 for a tractor. They're driving a tractor that's 6 decades old, literally 60-year-old, 50-year-old tractors. Well, a series of companies are offering retrofits on 60-year-old tractors to make them drive themselves. And the retrofit costs less than it costs to buy the 50-year-old tractor, not the $700,000 mega machine. But just to put a side note on that, in Ukraine, when Russia invaded, Ukraine is massive, massive grain fields covering most of the country. And a big chunk of those grain fields were taken by Russia early on, and they left with the tractors. And some of those tractors were massively expensive pieces of equipment.
When you say they left with the tractors,
the Russians,
the Ukrainians.
No, the Russians stole them because they came fast. The Ukrainians didn't say, I need to drive my tractor away at 3 miles an hour down the road. Right. So the Russians came and they took all these tractors, big ones, expensive ones, self-driving ones, and they got them home. And the Ukrainians reported, hey, these are stolen, and John Deere turned them all off. They're massive bricks that they drove at 3 miles an hour back to Russia, and now they don't work. So this sort of thing, you know, when we talk about security in your automobile, it's really, if you look at the theft rates on a Tesla, it's the lowest rate of theft of any automobile in its class. In every one of its classes. Why? Because it recognizes the driver, and if it's not the driver and the driver reports it, Tesla just shuts it down because it doesn't belong to that person. And then they know where it is, and it's not working. So this is some part of that new batteries and new security and better efficiency. All of that stuff leads to better productivity and a better quality of life. And we're seeing that explode everywhere. Sometimes literally on airplanes, when you're charging your phone, you shouldn't use a battery from cheap places because they explode. But technology is literally exploding as well as figuratively. That's all I'm saying. All right, go ahead.
So what you're saying is Grand Theft Auto is about to be displaced by something else.
Yeah, it's going to be very difficult on a regular basis in the future to steal an automobile. Mm. I mean, this is like a full circle. Back when automobiles were first introduced in a mass level, and I don't mean we're going to make a few of these. I mean, like the Model T. The Model T did not have a key. Mm-hmm. You could climb in the window because there wasn't glass on the sides. The door didn't open on the passenger side. It just was painted on. The way you started it was you got the crank out to the front and you cranked it out and you drove away. But nobody stole them. There were so few Model Ts stolen that it was considered ultra weird to have that happen because the thief didn't know how to drive an automobile. So they said, we don't even need keys. This is not that they had keys for their cart and buggy, or their horse and buggy. I just said cart and mm-hmm. buggy. Don't yeah. put your buggy well, in front of the cart.
It would be rough.
Yeah, right. It's some kind of weird convoy that doesn't go anywhere.
You could have a buggy cart, though.
Yes. That's very buggy if you don't have a horse involved. So the Model T wasn't stolen. Over the years, eventually the thieves learned how to drive a car, and the roads were there to make getaways easier. So by the 1920s, Grand Theft Auto was a real thing. People were stealing cars, even though it's only little more than a decade since cars were introduced in general to the, most people hadn't seen them a decade before. In the mid-1920s, people were stealing automobiles. So they started saying, well, what are we going to do? How are we going to fix this? Well, we'll have to use a key. We're going to have to use a key on the door. So at first they started with a key on the door, like at your house. They didn't have a key for the ignition. It was just a key for the door. Then eventually they discovered that if you had an ignition with a key into it, well, that was even extra because it wouldn't even start unless you had the key. Even if you broke the window to get in, you still couldn't car. Well, then they started hot wiring. And that's kind of been where car technology against thieves has been for a very, very long time. Now we have an extra level where the car is actually recognizing the driver. This sounds kind of like Knight Rider from my childhood, where somebody gets in the car and the car says, you are not my driver. And we thought, this is so funny. The car's not going to let it steal it. Well, we're here. And it's a car that anybody can buy. And it doesn't have the cool lights on the front that go back and forth, though. That's a thing of the past. That's old technology.
Yeah, but you can get those.
I suppose you could. You probably wouldn't cost much, and you could do it with LEDs.
No. Right. People do it.
So all of that is to say, when we talk about the long term, we're seeing that as the future. Now, we have a lot of speed bumps and a lot of things that could cause those things to occur slower or faster. There could be more war. There could be more famine. There could be a lot of things that influence this. But the preponderance of the new technology is leading us to a more comfortable life that makes us it makes it easier to do the things that we need to do. This is my last little comparison from childhood for this monologue, and then I'll hand off to you. As a kid, I watched The Jetsons, and it was a science fiction cartoon by Hanna-Barbera about what the world's going to look like when people have flying cars and the alarm clock will actually pick you up and put you through the shower and feed you while you're still half asleep and then put you in your clothes. And then the car will fly you to work and then you will drop out of it and it will go and park itself. So the flying part is still not reality. Well, there was an episode of The Jetsons where they thought this was very funny because his job at the factory was just to push one button repeatedly. He just continually pushed that one button. And this episode, they brought that more to the attention because it had been in other episodes. And his finger started to throb in a cartoonish way because he kept pushing this button. And that was the funny part, is that he got injured by pushing a button, and that was silly, and how could that ever happen? And now we look at carpal tunnel and repetitive use injuries and the number of people using braces on their wrists and their hands because they push buttons all day. It was predictive, and the fact that the car is going to park itself when you get to work is also predictive. I hope we don't have a machine yank us out of bed and put us through the shower and brush our teeth for us, because that really didn't look that comfortable unless you're a cartoon. But the rest of the stuff, we're experiencing things on a normal basis that not that long ago we would have thought was fiction.
I don't think we'll ever see the flying cars either.
Well, especially not if our eyes are closed.
I mean, at some point we might get there, but it'll be a long, 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 long,
long time. There's a lot of safety issues with cars coming down on top of people and...
That and weather. There is weather when even the most sophisticated self-landing, self-takeoff jet aircraft can't do it.
Yeah.
And
if your only way to get to work is in a flying car and there is a big storm, not going to work.
Of course, the thing that might happen is there may be less and less of going to work. There is. We suggested that 2 decades ago, that one of the things that would happen as digital communication came in, is there would be a significant portion of the economy where people didn't go to work.
Right. That they stayed at home and worked remotely.
Or they might work in a local center or something.
Right.
So that's true. Oh, and I've got some things I'd like to add here before we go to commercials.
Please do.
Let me give the most important one first. The SEC in the charged a man, or a company and a man, and the same time the Department of Justice filed criminal charges against this man. The name of the company was Prophecy Asset Management Advisory Firm. Prophecy, and it was an SEC registered investment advisor. And They took in $500 million, given the name of the firm. I suspect it was mostly from church members, and managed to disappear $350 million of it through losses. And $15 million of it went to the gentleman who was the president of the company.
I don't think gentleman is the right word.
I'm trying to be nice here. His name is John Hughes, and he basically took $500 million of investors' money, lost $350,000 of it through bad investments, and lost $350 million, pocketed $15 million. So there's not going to be much left to go back to the investors, and he's probably going to get to wear an orange jumpsuit into the future. But he's been doing this for years and years. And this is the interesting thing about it. It was only when he suspended withdrawals and stopped paying people income that people started complaining. Up till that point, over the years, everybody reported a profit. Why did they report a profit? Because he was the custodian too. His firm was the custodian, and they were sending out statements that said there's a nice profit in your account, and people were bragging about it, and more people would bring the more money in. And particularly since he was clearly a Christian, and obviously they could trust him, they kept doing that. But here's this story happens over and over and over again. Here's the key. I'm going to make a recommendation to you. I don't know if this doesn't count as investment advice, but it's advice about how to invest. Do not use an investment advisor who is part of the same company that has custody of your money. I'll say that again. Do not use an investment advisor who is part of the same company that has custody of your money. We get, it seems like at least once a quarter, the stagecoach company that is Wells Fargo. Yeah. Wells Fargo gets a multi-billion dollar fine for fraud and ripping off their investment clients and ripping off their banking clients, and people just keep giving the money. I don't understand that at all, because even at the SEC and at Federal Trade Commission, and again, I've seen this, there seems to be an enduring culture of fraudulent behavior at Wells Fargo. And even though they replaced the senior officers there, the culture of ripping off their customers continues, so that about once a quarter, they get a huge fine. Not that it hurts Wells Fargo, because it's a huge corporation, and they just pay their fines and move on. Although several of their executives are now wearing orange jumpsuits. There's other people who've moved up and I guess are willing to enrich themselves so they can wear orange jumpsuits too, because they just keep doing it over and over again, but people keep doing it. But here's the key. If you entrust your money to an advisor, an investment advisor, or if they call themselves a financial advisor, by definition, you are giving the money to the company they represent that they're part of. And that's probably a bad idea to begin with. If you are using an investment advisor, which is supposed to be a fiduciary position, and they are holding your money, and they are sending you statements, you don't have any way of knowing whether the money's there or not. If you use an independent, properly registered custodian, and you get your investment advice from a separate person or organization, the quality of the advice, I won't promise you whether the quality of advice is good or bad, but at least you're not in the position where the person who you see and to whom who transfers your money to wherever it goes is the person who can take your money. Uh-huh. And you should receive, therefore, let me get this last thing out. You should receive a statement monthly or at least quarterly from the organization that is a custodian, that is separate from and not affiliated with your advisor. If you make that division, you will head off probably 95 or 98% of the probability of getting your money stolen.
Yeah. I was going to fill in that this is called a custodian. It doesn't mean somebody that cleans your house. This is the person that the company that holds the assets. And if your advisor is the custodian as well as your advisor, that's where we say there's a conflict there. They're supposed to get third-party audits on a surprise basis while that's going on, but we prefer someone that's regularly third-party audited, just as an ongoing thing at a large institution where we can review those audits. So this is, we think that's pretty important. Obviously, we set our organization up that way as well. But we have to play some commercials.
We do.
If you would like to join the conversation, this is going to be the last about 10 minutes or so when we get back from commercials of this week's episode. You can send us emails at Jeff at tpwc.com and Jake at tpwc.com. That's Tango, Papa, Whiskey Charlie, or The Personal Wealth Coach. And it's a good time to send in. We've got a lot of stuff to say, but we'll answer any questions that we get as long as they're not too late. So we'll be back on the other side of these vitally important messages from our sponsors. And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and
Jeff McClure.
It sounds so presumptuous to say starring. It's like we're a stellar object somehow. We're starring in
a
program.
We are. I mean, stellar objects, stars, are just big balls of hot gas.
And we're full of that, is what you're saying.
Yeah. It fits.
I would say there's gas involved, but when they're actually in the star, it's more plasma than gas, just as a general state of change.
That's a specific thing, right?
Yeah. One quick thing I wanted to bring up. This is interesting because it's looking at treasuries as a percent of GDP on a graph. This was from a Wall Street Journal article. And the yields on treasuries peaked out way back in 1981, 82, at the end of 1981, at the beginning of 1982. And they were up 17%+ at one point. So the average rate was at 14.9% in August of 1981. Now, obviously, there's different yields on different maturities and all that stuff. This is the 10-year. And when we're looking back, we say, okay, well, we're obviously much lower than that now. But when we chart this long, long-term peak valley concept, the cycle of yields, where we go rising interest rate environment until we get really high, and then it drops for a long, long period, lowering interest rate environment for a very long time. The bottom of the lowering economic environment was in June of 2020. The peak was in right at the end of 1981. So if you go back before that, the former trough was in the 1940s, right after World War II. World War II end. If you go back to before that and look back to interest rates to that point, we had a lowering interest rate environment that went back to just prior to World War I. So we have these peaks and troughs, and they're about 40 years long. And that's been pretty consistent. We've talked about this on the program for years and years. To see the rising interest rate and how much it looks like coming off of World War II. During the pandemic, we went back to World War II to compare the pandemic to World War II as far as how we changed our economy and how it affected our workforce and all the big events there. We could say that the closest comparison that we could do with a lot of data was right at World War II. And it's funny because it's having the same impact on the long-term interest rate cycle. So there's a lot of people this last week, we had interest rates drop down over the last week, and it's all over the headlines. Interest rates fell. This is amazing. It's wonderful. The issue is that that concept means that people think that that's permanent. What I would tell people, and I would tell them again and again, is that if you just look back over time, we're in a rising cycle now. This is based on history. We just look back. We don't tend to have little ups followed by little downs repeatedly and staying in the same range. We tend to have it go really, really, really high over a period of 40 years, and then a really, really, really low over a period of 40 years, and then really, really high. So we're at the beginning of probably a 40-year cycle beginning. We're 3 years into it. And it started faster than most cycles, but it's starting to kind of slow down its growth. When we look at borrowing as a percentage of GDP, we have some other weirdness that comes up in the middle of this too. We peaked out our debt as a percentage of GDP. Our debts still continue to rise, by the way, but our GDP has been rising faster than the debt. And we peaked out our debt as a percentage of GDP, get this, in September of 2020. Well, that's right at when the interest rate cycle turned around. So this is so, I mean, we had a trough on a percentage of treasuries to GDP at the time that the interest rates were peaking in the early 1980s. So we, as a percentage of GDP, have less debt today than we did in 2020. We're at 102% of GDP now. Now, having said all of that, we're still borrowing more than we're making. And if we go back to prior to the pandemic, in 2019, we were at 85%. Of our GDP. And that's a much healthier way of being long-term. It looks like we're coming down to that, and it's going to happen naturally because this is interesting. As debt payments become
interesting. I got that.
Thank you. I work hard on that one. This is very interesting.
It's interesting.
the government is going to be concentrating more and more on the debt as the cost of the debt goes up. You just expect that to happen. It's the same thing that would happen anywhere else. It's 10% of our budget now. Just a few years ago, it was 2% of our budget. That's a big change. We're cutting things out that we would have paid for because we have debt, which means that we're going to be looking at debt differently. Expect interest rates to remain high and probably to continue to rise, not just for the next few years. That could go down a bit then, but over the next 30 plus, because that's where we are in history. This is how interest rate cycles work. You get into kind of a groove and you follow that groove until it gets too uncomfortable. That's true with lowering interest rates and raising interest rates. Banks got really uncomfortable down at the bottom of those interest rates. And moving back up, eventually the consumer's going to get really uncomfortable like they did in the late 70s and early 80s. And it has to go back the other way. So hopefully we never get back up to that 15% rate, but it's part of history enough times to say that we might. It's more likely than not that we will. But that's a long ways in the future. So don't complain so much about having a 7.5% mortgage, because in 10 years, that might be considered ultra low. And if you've got a 3% mortgage in 10 years, they're going to think that you're a leprechaun or something, that you have magical powers. Well, we have about 3 minutes for a wrap up before we have to close out. I'm going to take a real quick thing to say something we say when the economy's good or bad. Live within your means. Don't consistently have more debt than you're making. If you're getting debt on a house that you're going to pay for the whole time that you're there, that makes a lot more sense than getting into consumer debt. Make sure you have enough money in the bank so that the next emergency, not if it happens, but when it happens, doesn't cause you to have to use a credit card, because the banks will love you, but you won't love the banks. Buy something because you know what you're going to use it for, whether it's an investment or anything else. Don't just buy something because it's a spur of the moment thing. And those are things that I say in up markets and down markets and bad economies and good. And if you follow those little things, it's kind of like wearing your seatbelt every day. It's probably not going to save you on any specific day, but when it does, it adds up. And you want to do the rest of the wrap up?
Okay. Same story as last hour. We added 150,000 jobs in October, which is just almost exactly the amount the Fed would like us to add in a month. The inflation is running along at about month to month right now at about 1.2 to 2.4, which is bracketing the 2% that the Fed wants it to do. We saw a 4.7 annualized rate of productivity growth in the third quarter. And of course, we reported last week that 4.9% annualized GDP growth in the third quarter. As a point of contrast, the European Union GDP for the third quarter was a negative 0.6%. China's economic situation, according to their PMI reports that just came out, is looking more and more grim. You are living, if you're listening in the United States, you're living in the country with the fastest, the biggest economy. This is the fastest economic growth in the world right now. It is the most stable economically of any country in the world, of any country or block of countries in the world. It just doesn't get a lot better than this. Things are running along amazingly smoothly. Unemployment is at 3.9%, which is certainly higher than the record lows we had, but the record lows we had were inflationary. And 3.9 is very close to the 4% that the Fed would like to see. Admittedly, I'm confident this will get out of balance at some point in the future. But as Jake said, the last thing I wanted to say was that the longer-term interest rates will probably continue to rise. And go ahead, Jake.
Yeah. If you would like to talk to us off the air, we actually give personalized fiduciary investment advice and portfolio management. We don't just blather on all day, though we do that too. You can reach us locally at
254-947-1111.
Or you can reach us toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, where you can read our newsletter, sign up for it. Comes out every Friday. By email. You can go listen to our radio programs going back a long ways. Find podcasts anywhere you find podcasts, TPWC podcasts. You can contact us through the contact form or Jeff at tpwc.com or Jake at tpwc.com. Until next week, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach. Thank you very much for listening.